We discussed last week the fact that what I'm doing in this series of Shiurim is... Really? Oh, thank you. Thank you for telling me. What I'm trying to do in this series is provide a set of lenses from which to see the world differently, to see the world through the Torah and not to see the Torah through the world. And that really defines the difference between a secular outlook and a Torah outlook. A secular outlook looks at the Torah. It's not as if secular Jews don't study the Torah. They do. They read the Torah every Shabbos and they study it. And whatever they do. But the difference between the way a Talmid Chochum studies the Torah, the way a Ben Torah studies the Torah, as opposed to the way somebody secular studies the Torah is, do you use secular eyes to see the Torah or do you use Torah eyes to see the secular world? Now, most people don't want to see the secular world through Torah eyes. Because if you really see the secular world through Torah eyes, it looks different. And that different perception, if you're then honest with yourself, it then challenges you to possibly make some significant modifications in your life. So it's not a popular thing to do. It's much more popular to teach the Torah through secular eyes because that won't challenge you to do anything. It's not going to challenge your paradigm. It'll give you some new information and it'll give you a new insight and it'll give you a new understanding of a posuk and it'll be a vort on the parsha that you can say over at the Shabbos table. It's not going to change lives because you're looking at it still from a secular perspective. The only time you change or you might change your life is when something or someone compels you to look at the world through a different lens. Sometimes it's a life event. Sometimes one suffers a very disruptive event, a death of a dear one, an immigration, a divorce. These things shake you up and require that you take a look at the world through a different lens. A child goes through adolescence, they start looking at the world through a different lens. A person hits mid-age, starts looking at the world a little differently. A person hits 60, starts looking at the world very differently. There are life events that cause one to look at the world differently and sometimes to get one to change the way one lives. One can go to a physician and one can be in their good health and in one's 20s and the physician can say you need to change your eating habits, you need to do more exercise, you need to stop smoking in the days that people used to smoke. And how do we respond to that if our lenses haven't changed? Yeah. That's it. Nothing changes. We hear it, and every day they repeat it. Remember I told you last time, you ought to watch your weight. Your weight's going up. Yeah. Nothing happens. God forbid there's a heart attack. Sorry about that. God forbid there's a tragedy, there's a heart attack or a stroke or something terrible, and all of a sudden everything changes. And the reason that everything changes is not because there's any new information. There's nothing that you know after you've had a heart attack, God forbid, that you didn't know before. No new information. But the world looks different. Your value system has changed. That's what happens when there's a disruption in a life. Your value system changes. And the only reason I'm interested in teaching Torah is to help people modify, evolve, and sometimes change their value system. I'm totally not interested in sharing information because there's more than enough information available. You don't need rabbis anymore for that. There was a time where you needed a rabbi to give you information. Now you don't. It's on the internet. Even if you've got a shayla, you don't need a rabbi anymore. In fact, you can put the answer in the internet and you'll get the authority who'll give you the heter. It's completely manipulable. There's no need anymore for a rabbi. Just the same with teaching and education. A rabbi's role is no longer to give halachic decisions and to provide information and insights. That's not his role anymore. We don't need him for that. So rabbis, like many other people, have to redefine their profession. So what is my role? What does one have to do? And as far as I'm concerned, the only reason to teach Torah, the only reason that I would be interested in investing the hours it takes to prepare and to deliver it, the only reason is if there's a chance that one person will put on a new pair of lenses and see the world differently. Just one person. Then it's worth it. So that's the purpose of the series. And the warning is, the caveat is, it's not always comfortable. When you look at the world, you sometimes see it in a different light, not the way you would like to see it. Sometimes we like to see the world the way it's always been. But the world is changing, and so are we. And the question is, are we just going to be functions of that change and in a passive way kind of ride along? Or are we going to be to some degree architects of the change, if not changes in the world, which we could also be, at least the changes in ourselves are we going to be architects of? Or are we just going to watch it happen? And learning Torah allows you to be an architect of your own change. It allows you to adjust your lens. It allows you to look at the world from a new insight and to understand new things and to see things in a new way. It allows you to be able to do those things, which then become so important and so valuable as we move forward. So the lenses that I want to use today, or the assumptions that I want to look at today, and we saw last week how we start shaking assumptions, things that we assume to be correct. When you put on a new set of lenses, they're not correct. And one has to see them from a different viewpoint, from a different perspective. So the two things I want to look at is, the one stems from last week and is a continuation of it. I can see we're going to have trouble with this recording today as well. We have a backup. The one that we're going to deal with, the assumption is, what is, if we look through a Torah lens, what is our view of environmentalism? What is our relationship to the planet? How concerned do we have to be about it? And that's a big issue today, and it's a very popular issue. And a lot of people are most nefesh. They make great sacrifices to take care of sustainability. How important is that, and where does it fit into a Torah view when you're using your Torah spectacles? And the second one is perhaps an even more important issue, which is about value. And the relationship between value and values. And I want to tell you why I think it's so important, because there's information and misinformation. So in the year 2013, so far, 950,000 jobs have been added into the United States economy. That's pretty impressive. Recession's turning around. Employment's moving up. What we're not told is that 75% of those jobs are part-time and are generating incomes of less than $22,000. That we're not being told. So the additional nearly 1 million jobs are for people who are working very part-time. If you look at July alone, the last month for which we have clear statistics, if you look at July alone, there were 170,000 new part-time jobs created just in July. Full-time jobs, a loss of 92,000. So the statisticians will tell you, in July there was a 78,000 net gain of jobs. Not true. There was a 98,000 loss of jobs. So we're shifting, and some people are writing, that we're shifting into a part-time economy. The reason, many analysts suggest, Obamacare. Now, it's easy to blame everything on Obama. And people, the cost of employing people is now much higher. And people don't know what it's going to cost. And they don't want to get themselves locked into responsibilities to employees that will burden them to a degree that they can't manage. So they are postponing hiring. And one of the views is, but when that all sorts out eventually, full-time hiring will get back to normal. And I would like to suggest, not necessarily so. I don't believe, and I'm just putting something out there, and it's for you to think of as you want and to listen to the shir in 10 years' time. I don't believe the economy that we have created is one that provides jobs. I think the era of jobs is over. There aren't jobs. There are very few jobs. And there are going to be fewer and fewer jobs. We don't need jobs. That's what's important to understand. Because somewhere in the world there are people who will do our jobs cheaper than we will. And there are machines that can do our jobs better than we can. So the only jobs are the people who are creating the machines to make jobs unnecessary. And one person can create a machine that can make 1 million jobs unnecessary. So the leveraging of that understanding leads to an economy where jobs are going to be very few and far between. So what are an increasing number of unemployed people going to do? And we're seeing it already. University graduates are struggling. They've got these massive loans. In the old days, you took out a loan because with a university degree, you got a job. And if you got a job, you could pay off your loan. We're in a new economy, a jobless economy. So your university degree isn't worth anything in the job market because there isn't a job market. Jobs are very rare. You can start your own business for which you don't need a university degree. And you can, if you want to, spend a lot of money on getting a university degree and maybe getting one of those few jobs if you're willing to work for very little or you are super bright. Not in an academic way, but in a practical way too. It would have to be one of those things. Either you're going to be willing to work for $20,000 or you're going to have to be so bright that people are willing to pay a lot. And there are lots of people. America's a big country, so there are lots of people who are super bright. But not as many people, or rather, not as many people as would be able to supply jobs for everybody. So I'm suggesting we have to start getting used to the idea that the old world, and we say it all the time, the old world is over. I don't think we have any clue of how over the old world is. And I don't think we have it because we're still coasting along on momentum. It's like the Titanic, just moving along to the iceberg. And we're still having our dances, and we're listening to the music, and we're watching movies, and we're drinking champagne, and we're heading straight for the iceberg. It's so obvious, it's so clear. But it's uncomfortable. Who wants to say iceberg? It's against the American culture to say things might not be better tomorrow. American culture is always things will be better tomorrow. So invest in the future. And in many areas they will be better. Big corporations will make big profits. Because they know how to utilize and manage this new world. But the ordinary Joe who needs a job and his children need jobs are in a new environment where jobs don't exist because the concept of job doesn't exist. The Gemara says about the time of Mashiach that the Jews will have a time where melachtom na'aseh al yedei acherim. Their work will be done by others. Now, what I never used to understand when I used to learn that Chazal was it doesn't mean other people. It means by mechanization, by automation. People won't have to work. Now, the Chazal say that about the Jewish people, because that's what it's talking about. We'll be able to learn Torah, we'll be able to study Torah, and we'll be able to do what we need to do. What about Parnosa? It'll be automated. We won't have to do it. But that's not only the Jews. That means the world in which we're living is a world in which work will no longer be necessary. That's where we're going. Certainly for educated people. So how will they earn a living? Big question. Nobody's asking. Nobody's asking the question. In the post-job economy, how will a growing number of job entrants earn a living? What will they do? I don't know the answer. America doesn't farm anymore that much. It doesn't produce in factories anymore. It doesn't. It gets other laborers to do it. What are these people going to do? Go and live in China? And work for Chinese wages? So the question isn't answered, and asked and answers aren't given. But I'm going to propose an answer to you tonight, but it's not a comfortable answer. That's a wonderful answer, but it's not comfortable. And just for fun, let's explore it. And I'm not an economist, and maybe it's nonsensical. But I would doubt that it's nonsensical. It might have to be evolved and developed a little bit. So let's play with it. Starting on the environment area. The Ramban says on the psukim we've just been learning, where Hashem gives the blessing to the first man and says, "Pruruvu milu et haaretz, fill the world up, v'kivshuha, and conquer the earth." He doesn't say nurture the earth. He doesn't say protect the earth. Be careful with the earth. Earth is very robust. Humanity is fragile. The planet is not. The planet is not fragile. The planet will last as long as Hashem wants it to last. It will outlive all of us. Don't have to worry about the planet. Whether we'll last, we might make life untenable for us. We might poison ourselves. We might kill ourselves off. But the planet will be there. But that's not what people are saying. People are not saying you've got to do these things to save human life. They say to save the planet. And I would suggest saving the planet as an ideal is a form of avodah zarah. That's a form of idolatry. Saving human life, that's Torah. That you've got to take care of if carbon dioxide and all this thing and global warming is bad for people, then we've got to worry. But if it's fine for people, it's just not good for the planet. We have no obligation to worry about the planet. Now there's a big if to all this, there's a big condition to all of this, which I'll come to in a moment. Says the Ramban. What does that mean? It means Natan Laim Koach Umemshala Ba'aretz La'asot Kirtzonam. Hashem gave man the governance over earth to do as he pleases. The animals and the little creepy things and anybody on the land. Velivnot and to build. Velakor and to break down. Natoa to plant and uproot. Umeharerea lachatzov nechoshet and to extract copper from the mountains. That's what we're meant to do. We're meant to extract the minerals, build, create, design. That's what we're meant to do. Not worry about the planet living. We're there to use the planet's resources to enhance human life, because the highest ideal is human life, not the planet. And even though it says la'ochla, I give all this to you to eat, that is only on the vegetation. In the time of Adam, we were only allowed to eat vegetables and fruit, grasses. We were not allowed to eat meat. So our ruling over the animal world was not for the purpose of eating. What is ruling over the animal world? To use the animal world for labor, for scientific research, for experimentation, for whatever we need to use animals for. We're entitled to use animals. They're there to serve humans. Now that's the Torah lens. It's not the popular secular lens, but that's the Torah lens. The planet is there for us. We're not here for the planet. Planet is here for us. We're here for God. That's the way it works. If you take God out of the picture, well then planet, people, who's there for who, could be either way. There's no hechrech, there's nothing compelling you to say the planet's here to serve people, or people are here to preserve the planet. But if you put God into the equation, then the planet is here to serve people. By planet I mean all of nature is here to serve mankind, and mankind is here to serve God. What is the caveat? The caveat is that we're meant to be worthy of that. Because here's the idea. The Abarbanel says, why was man not given his own day for creation? Every other species has their own day. We share it with the animals. Why? The sixth day on Friday, all the animals were created and we. Why? Says the Abarbanel, because it's not so clear we're going to be human. That's within our choice. You remember last week, we can choose which operating system works. We can choose whether we're going to be elevated angelic human beings or we're going to be animals. If we're going to live as animals, then there's nothing that differentiates us. What differentiates us from last week did we say Tzelem Elohim? And what is Tzelem Elohim? Lahavinu lahaskil. To study, to learn, to think, to extrapolate, to innovate, to create ideas. That's what makes us human. If we're not doing that, we're animals. We're very sophisticated animals, very evolved animals. But we're animals. And we're created on Friday because we're potentially animals, says the Ramban. And so the only reason that we're allowed to use Earth, the planet, nature, is because if we are great human beings and we use the planet to serve us, that elevates the planet, it doesn't lower the planet. So what's really important, what becomes the Jewish, the Torah view of conservation, the Torah view of environmentalism? You're worried about the planet? Become a mensch. You're worried about the planet? Become a greater human being. You worry about the planet? Increase your avodas Hashem. And then every interaction you have with the planet elevates the planet. It doesn't bring it down. You know from your own life, if you have an interaction with a real grob, base, nothing of a human being, how do you feel afterwards? Elevated, neutral, or downgraded? You feel downgraded. You need a shower. You feel you need to wash that all off. And when you interact with somebody great, when you come across somebody really exceptional, somebody who's worked on themselves, who's refined, who's developed, who's brilliant,
and you're in their presence, what do you feel afterwards? You feel elevated. The world is exactly the same. That our ability to interact with the world depends on who we are. Not on what we do with the world. It's on who we are. So the Maseiras Yesharim says that's the whole idea of Kedusha. And he gives the example of when Yaakov lies down to sleep, and we're told he takes from the stones of the place, and then afterwards it says the stone in the singular, and Chazal say why plural then singular, and Chazal say because the stones began to argue, each one saying, Alai Yaniach Tzadik Rosho, let the Tzadik put his head and rest his head on me. Each stone wanted that. And they started arguing with each other, and so they became one stone. What's the Chazal telling us? Nature wants to be used by great people. Nature doesn't want to be abandoned and left to evolve and do its own thing. Nature thrives when it's used by great people. Nature deteriorates when it's used for bad things. Nature deteriorates when the people who interact with it are not great people. Then nature deteriorates. And if one's very sensitive, one can see that. And it's so much so that the Gemara in Psochim says, listen to this, Am Haaretz. What is an Am Haaretz? Am Haaretz is not a complementary term in the Gemara. But what's interesting is in the Gemara, there's not a word for frum and not frum. No such word as frum in the Gemara. It doesn't appear. There's not even a word like Shomer Shabbos and not Shomer Shabbos kind of thing. That's not what differentiates people. The differentiator, the boundary line in the Gemara, all the way through is Am Haaretz, Talmid Chacham. So you're an Am Haaretz, you can be an Am Haaretz and Frum. You can't be a Talmid Chacham and not Frum, but you can be an Am Haaretz and Frum. What is an Am Haaretz? Am Haaretz means a person of the land. What does it really mean? It means a person whose head is attached to the world. He's thinking about the world. And a Talmid Chacham is thinking about how the world is through the Torah's lenses. Am Haaretz sees the world through the lens of nature, the lens of science, the lens of economics. That's an Am Haaretz. A Talmid Chacham sees the world through the lens of Torah. So you'll see right away that many of us are Am Haaretzim. We don't like to think of ourselves that way, but an Am Haaretz doesn't mean you're ignorant. It doesn't mean you don't know. An Am Haaretz means how do you look at the world? Do you look at the world through a Torah lens or through a secular lens? That's what determines whether you're a Talmid Chacham or an Am Haaretz. So now listen to the Gemara. Am Haaretz osur lechol bosor. An Am Haaretz is not permitted to eat meat. Did you know that? Quite serious now to know whether one's an Am Haaretz or not. Because if you're an Am Haaretz, we aren't allowed to eat meat. Now this halacha was not adopted because people weren't keeping it. But it's important to understand the ideal. The ideal was, you can't kill an animal and consume it if that's not going to elevate the animal. What right have you got to destroy the animal if it's not going to elevate the animal's soul, so to say? If you're not going to elevate the animal world by using it for greatness in human being, by using it to sustain human greatness, what right have you to do that? V'chol she'eino osek ba'torah. Anybody who is not Oisek Batorah. Oisek Batorah, if you want to see what that means, you need to look in the Taz and the Shulchan Aruch on the Brocha of Lasuk B'Divrei Torah. We say the Brocha every morning, but we don't understand what it means. Oisek Batorah means you make Torah your business. And I'll give you some examples of it later on. What does Torah your business mean? How does a businessman look at the world? How does he look at opportunities? How does he read the newspaper? Through the eyes of his own business. How's this going to affect my business? What is there an opportunity here for my business? How is this going to affect the future for my business? Everything he looks at is through the eyes of his business. Oisek b'Torah is one who sees the world through the eyes of Torah. And somebody who is not an Oisek b'Torah, also le'echol bosor, is not allowed to eat meat. So you see here, yes, we use the world. The world is here, nature is here to serve us. But who is the us? The us is people with Tzelem Elohim. The us is people who living that human image, that are living the lahavinu lahaskil, they're seeing the world through lahavinu lahaskil, they're seeing the world through eyes of intellect and spirituality and sanctity. That's really what it is. Sanctity, intellect, and the combination. The Torah is probably the only discipline in the world that combines the highest levels of sanctity with the highest levels of intellect. There have been articles floating around the internet the last few days. You might have seen it, a BBC article specifically, exploring why Talmud has become so popular and why you've got great intellects spending so much time studying the Talmud. And they quote Einstein saying towards the end of his life when he was asked, what regrets have you got? He said, my only regret is that I didn't study Talmud. And they ask, what is it about Talmud? And they're beginning to explore it. And you know that the Koreans have been doing research as to what it is. Talmud, Gemara, is the one thing that synthesizes sanctity and intellectual brilliance. Yeah, the two together, you can't have one without the other. If you're not in a state of sanctity, you're not going to access the brilliance. If you don't access the brilliance, you can't access the sanctity. They work together. There's no other study in the entire world that does that. You've got studies of sanctity, but that's all kind of very ethereal, and you kind of do that thing, and you've got brilliance. But where brilliance and sanctity intersect, that's the Torah. That is what the Torah is. True brilliance, and absolute sanctity. That's the Torah. That's Gemara. So somebody who isn't learning Gemara, who isn't in that phase, in that state of Oisek BaTorah, shouldn't be eating meat. But if he is, if a person is in that state of sanctity, then by eating meat, that's not a disservice to the animal. The animals line up and say, I want to be eaten by the tzaddik, the same as the stones line up and say, I want the tzaddik to put my head on me. It's an amazing aliyah, it's an amazing elevation for nature when nature serves great human beings. When nature serves ordinary human beings, it's no elevation at all. So what is our responsibility to nature? Become a great human being. That's our responsibility to nature, never mind to God. It's our responsibility to the planet. Because if we're not great, then our consumption of the planet defiles and erodes the sanctity of the planet itself. So that's really our responsibility, through Torah eyes. Let's move into the second piece. Values. So I said to you that we might be moving into an economy where there are no jobs. It's just a jobless economy. So the question will be, how will people earn livings? This will be the first time in history that they're not jobs. How will you earn a living? So I suggest something absurd. But you tell me what's wrong with it logically. What would happen if everybody said, you know what, I don't need $200,000 a year to live. I don't even need 150. I don't even need 100. I'm happy to earn 50 and work 3 days a week. Let somebody else get the other half of the job. We're all so in pursuit of every last penny that now jobs become the rare commodity. There was a time where money was the rare commodity. Now money is not a rare commodity. There's as much money as you want. You know, money is not a problem. The government prints it. It's not a problem. Money is not the issue. The issue is jobs. Jobs is the scarce commodity. And we're grabbing whatever one is available. What would happen if everything turned around and people said, if people became generous with jobs? You know what generous with tzedakah is? This is a new world. We're going to need a new definition of tzedakah. Tzedakah isn't here, take some of my money. Tzedakah is here, take half of my job. Then what would happen? Or take 2/3 of my job. So what would we need? Do you understand? I mean, tell me what's wrong with that. So yes, we wouldn't be able to live in Beverly Hills. Correct, but we would save the world. Everybody's worried about saving the planet. But the economy's going down. We won't need a planet because we'll die of hunger. There'll be no money, there'll be no jobs. So stop worrying about the planet and start worrying about the economy. And we're not going to resolve the economy by carrying on doing the things we've always done. It's a different economy. So what would happen if everybody said, okay, so we don't live in Beverly Hills. I'll live in a small village somewhere in America or elsewhere. And I'll be satisfied with $30,000 a year, $50,000 a year, $70,000 a year. Let somebody else take the rest of my job. I'll give my job away. That's my tzedakah. What would happen then if I started giving my jobs away? So I can't understand what would be so bad. Of course, we would all have less money. And that's hard for us to think about. What would we do? How would we live? How would we cope? A very, very wealthy man and a very wonderful man, I might have quoted before, said to me when I was visiting Australia a couple of weeks ago, wonderful person, remained very humble even as he's become very, very wealthy. He said, the only thing wealth does for you is it turns your necessity, your luxuries into necessities. That's it. So at the end of the day, it doesn't matter where on the scale you are. There's certain things which are luxuries and certain things which are necessities. So for some people, having 3 meals a day is a luxury. 2 meals is a necessity. For other people, having steak once a week is a luxury. Having 3 meals is a necessity. For others, going out to a fancy restaurant every night is a luxury. Everything else, it just depends where on the scale you are. So by my suggestion of totally downsizing our need for jobs, we would have to do it the other way around. We would have to start turning luxuries into necessities. We would have to start turning necessities into luxuries. And saying what used to be a necessity is really just a luxury. When I get that my head around that, everything changes. Yes, it's nice to live in Beverly Hills, but that's not a necessity, it's a luxury. I could live somewhere else on half the income. And then what would I do with the other half? I wouldn't have the other half in my model. I would give it away as tzedakah. I would make sure that somebody else has the other half. So 2 of us will live in a small city instead of 1 of us living in Beverly Hills and the other one on the street. That's the kind of society we would have to create. What has to change for that to happen? So I'm going to tell you some stories. I'll tell you, so you'll see the economy through the Torah lens. Now, I'm not telling you this to suggest that tomorrow you should go and live this way. I know that's not possible. I'm just giving you lenses, just a way to look at the world, just a different way to see the world. There was a Rav in Vilna called Rav Moshe Kremer. And he was a very loved Rav and a very effective Rav in Vilna a couple of centuries ago. And he didn't take a salary from the Kehila, which is not the reason he was loved. He was loved because he was a great rabbi and a very fine person. He didn't take a salary from the Kehila because his wife ran a little business. And he was able to live from the little business. The Kehila felt it wasn't right. He was doing wonderful work and they were growing and there was shiurim and he was available for them and he was just a wonderful person. So they decided they've got to give him a salary. He wouldn't hear of it. The reason, by the way, that these rabbonim wouldn't hear of it, there were a number of reasons, but the 2 reasons that concern us is, number one, the possibility of bribery. That once I'm being paid, I've got to be careful what I say. Because what happens if I tell people, I give people a lens with which to work, look at the world, and the president of the shul is kindly and honoring us with his presence, and he doesn't like the lens I'm giving if I'm being paid by him. I'll be careful what I say. So the rabbonim of those times just didn't want to be in that position. I need to be able to say what's true, and that's it. The second reason they didn't want to take money is because of the time it entails. They didn't want to have to be responsible to somebody else for their time. And you'll see that in a moment. So the community thought of a great idea. They would start supporting her shop. And then he wouldn't even notice because he wouldn't accept the money. So the news got around the town that everybody must go and support the shop. She started doing better and better. And he, Rabbi Kremer, started noticing that money was coming into the house. Most of us, using secular lenses to view the Torah, would have said, Baruch Hashem, miracles. He said, oh my goodness, this is terrible. Where's this coming from? Who do we owe? What's happening? And he figured out what was happening, and he then made a calculation of how much they used to spend in the very beginning when he came to Vilna. He gave that amount to his wife, and he said, every week you open the shop. When you hit that number, you close the shop. That's all we need. Let other people have Parnosa the rest of the week. That's what he said. And that meant his time was free. Take it further. The Taz. The Taz is one of the most important commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch. And his father-in-law, the Bach, is one of the most important commentaries on the two halachic pillars of our civilization. And the Taz, this is now going back to 1615, was the Rav in Ostra. And he went on a visit and passed through the city of Brisk. And who was the Rav of Brisk? The Rav of Brisk was the Taz's father-in-law, the Bach, whose name was Rabbi Yoel Sirkish. So he goes into his father-in-law, and they used to love to meet always. Whenever they met, they were very friendly, they were very close, they would talk to Torah. Came in, it was a Thursday when he came to his father-in-law's home in Brisk, and Erev Shabbos, he gives his father-in-law a purse of coins, 60 gold coins, and says, please put them in the safe until after Shabbos. Father-in-law takes them, the Bach takes them, and hardly speaks to his son-in-law the entire Shabbos. The end of Shabbos, the son-in-law goes back, asks for the purse. He says, by the way, father-in-law, what happened to Shabbos? Why didn't we have a good relationship to Shabbos? He said, because I'm terribly disappointed. How could you have got 60 gold coins other than that it was dishonest? Somebody paid you for a judgment, somebody paid you for a din Torah, somebody paid you to do a rabbinic function. Where else would you have got it from? You're not in business. And I was terribly disappointed. And he laughed, the Taz. He said, I'm going to get my eyes attended to in Warsaw, whenever it is, Krakow, I'm going to. And my family raised the money to help me with the operation that I have to have. That's what it is. It's tzedakah money. That is pure charity. I couldn't afford the medical procedures that I have to have for my eyesight. And then they became friends. The level, do you see what that is? That if you've got money in that situation, how could you? You wouldn't have spent time earning the money. I know that you wouldn't do that, says the Bach. I don't think for a moment you started doing business deals. You wouldn't have taken your mind off the Torah. So where did you get it from? It must have come from somewhere dishonest. That's what worries me. And dishonest doesn't mean he stole it or it was bribery in the normal sense. All it means is somebody paid you to do something you shouldn't have been paid to do. That's what must have happened. That's where they were at. And you might say, well, that's a long time ago, 17th century. There was a young man, he's not a young man anymore. Today he's one of the brightest minds in the world of Torah, although not very well known. And he was a student of my father. And through my father's efforts, landed up marrying my cousin. He is an actuary, and my cousin, who's no longer alive, was a mathematician. And they raised their six children, I think they had, in a little two-room apartment in Yerushalayim. And when I was in yeshiva, I used to stay there. They didn't have six children as well, but they used to have guests on top of it. In a two-room apartment. Wow, an actuary. Couldn't he afford? And I asked him once, I said, why don't you work for a week a year? Just 1 week a year. You would earn enough to be able to afford a nice place and to live normally, and your wife wouldn't have to work so hard. And she intervened. And she said, because I wouldn't allow him to. Why not? Because I don't want his mind off Torah even for a week a year. I don't even want that. The idea that time is more valuable than money is the world seen through a Torah lens. The world through a secular lens is time is money. Have you ever heard that? Time is money? It's a terrible thing to say. What's more scarce? Money or time? When the United States runs out of money, what does it do?
Prints.
It makes more. That's all it does, which is a form of theft because it reduces the value of the money. But that's okay. So you run out of money, you steal if you're a government. It's okay. And if you run out of time, what do? Go on it. There's absolutely nothing you can do. The only truly scarce commodity is time. So how can you say time is money? Shouldn't you be saying money is time? How much time can I afford on money is the question a Jew asks. A secular person says, how much time can I afford on Torah? Because time is money, you know. See the difference? And we have to ask ourselves honestly and truly, where are we? Are we really time is money, or are we money is time? Where are we? How do we run our lives? How do we think we believe? How do we run our lives is what we've got to ask ourselves. And it won't take any of us very long to conclude we run our lives that time is money, not money is time. Because we see the Torah through a secular lens, not the secular world through a Torah lens. And again, you say that that's something very far and very distant. It's quite interesting that the Torah Tamima writes a beautiful history book of his time, and he quotes in there, interesting, I don't know where he comes across it, he quotes the Torah Tamima, who lived 100 years ago, whenever it was, quotes a book published in Philadelphia in 1905 by a person called H. Alsas. And he writes in this book, written in 1905, that in 1750 there were, and he names a list of Talmidei Chachomim who lived in Charleston, South Carolina, who wouldn't take money for rabbonis. They were Talmidei Chachomim who taught Torah and ran communities and earned a meager living from a trade or from some whatever they could and refused any effort on the part of the community to remunerate them. It's interesting. South Carolina, apparently until the early 1800s, was the biggest Jewish population in the United States. There were only 2,000, the height of it in South Carolina, but that was bigger than any other state. And during that time, end of the 18th century, this is what he writes. There were people in the United States at that time to whom time was more important than money. They wouldn't trade time for money. To put in time in order to get money. Time had to be free. Time had to be available to do what needs to be available. So when I said that what do we need? We need people who are willing to be generous with their jobs. What does that mean? Become more miserly with their time. We're generous with our time, but we're miserly with our jobs. We won't let anybody else have our job. We hold on to it for dear life. We don't even give other people information in case they'll take our job. We build all sorts of protections to make sure that nobody else does take our job. We're very protective of our jobs. We'll give a bit of time, but we won't give our jobs. It needs a complete switch. It needs people to say, but for that actually you need a societal change in values. Here's what I mean. Currently, status is defined by your disposable income. Certainly in the United States. How much money have you got, but how much disposable money have you got? That's what really defines status. How much money can you throw around? How much money can you give out to philanthropy or spend on something lavish? That's what really creates status. Solve a problem, throw money at it. Bill Gates does some wonderful work with his money, but that gives an enormous amount of status. He has disposable income. He has money he can throw at the global malaria problem. And that's better than throwing it at things that other people throw at. Obviously, it's wonderful. But that gives status. To have the money available to throw at something is what provides status in our society. The shift you would need is for people with disposable time to be the people with status. You imagine if you saw somebody, and today it kind of works like that, but it's linked to money. So if you saw somebody sitting in Beverly Hills here, sipping his coffee in the middle of the day, you notice him, and he's relaxed, he's reading, he's writing, he's listening to music, completely relaxed. And you watch him, he's there for 3 or 4 hours. Think interesting, you come the next day, he's there again. The next day, he's there again, enjoying himself, talking to people. And you know a little bit about him, and you know he doesn't have much money. And you say to him, how are you doing this? And he says, because I work for a few hours a day, and I've got enough to live on. I prefer doing this than working. I enjoy this more than working. So this is what I do. And then you have somebody else who spends their time at a university, learning, studying. Somebody else who spends their time in a kola, learning Torah. Somebody else is learning to play a new instrument. But they're living on a very low level in terms of economics. Not in poverty, but very simply. So what's happened? They're simply saying, I prefer to do what I like to do than to work at a job. Let somebody else have half a part of my job. I'll have a third of my job. Let two other people do the other two-thirds, and that leaves me free two-thirds of the day. What's the price I've got to pay? I can't live as lavishly. But look how I can live. I can spend my time the way I want to. Can you? And he points his finger at me. How much disposable time have you got? And I would have to say, what kind of? Nothing. Shabbos. And what do you do on Shabbos? I'm exhausted, so I sleep. Huh. Is that a life? So who's got greater status? Well, in our society, the slave to the job has greater status. But why does it have to be that way? What would happen if that switched? So what I'm saying is, if we look at the economy through the Torah's eyes, and we could create a Torah-like economy, we could prepare ourselves for a new economy that doesn't need as many jobs. Well, you'll still have it. You'll have the many jobs, but it will be 3 or 4 people doing the job of one instead of one doing the job of 4. That will be the difference, because our desire will be for disposable time, not for disposable income. Disposable time will be considered a much greater status symbol than disposable income. The fact that you can sit and do what you want to do, that's what everybody will envy. And when people start envying them, and these will become the experts on television when somebody wants to, and you'll see one of these people being interviewed, and you'll have books written about them, and their biographies will be written, then you'll get the shift. As long as we're going to worship and glamorize the people who are slaves to their work, which is all of us, we're never going to solve the problem of what are we going to do in an environment that doesn't need that many people working. So that's an example of looking at the world through the eyes of the Torah, not looking at the Torah through the eyes of the world. Understanding a different angle. We looked at environmentalism, the fact that if we want to do anything for the planet, what we need to do is do something for ourselves, is raise ourselves so that the planet can find meaning and value in serving humanity and not be demeaned by serving humanity. If the planet is uplifted by serving humanity, it will find all the resources it needs. How many times have we had the prophets of doom telling us that there's not enough food on the British Isles to support the British people? 20 years down the line was what Malthus said. And of course the Industrial Revolution came, and one ingenious idea by one man changed all that. And then everybody's saying there's not enough coal in the world to be able to support the industry. And one ingenious man comes and discovers you don't need coal, you can use nuclear energy. There's not enough oil in the world, and all of a sudden we find oil wells popping up all over the place. Don't worry about resources on the planet. If we are worth being served, the planet will rise to the occasion. If we are not worth being served, the planet will shrink. The planet will shrink in its value, in its importance, and in its worthiness. And the second idea in the area of value and values, that we are moving into a different world. We need different eyes. We need different thinkers. We can't carry on thinking about tomorrow using the tools of yesterday, because the tools of yesterday don't apply tomorrow. So we've got to find new assumptions for the way the world works. And those new assumptions require different ways of looking at the world. And through Torah, one sees the world in a different way. And again, I'm not saying that we can change all of that tomorrow or that it's going to change tomorrow. Just giving a sense of how a shift in values can completely shift an economy and provide a way into a new environment which is not as lavish but far richer. Thank you.